Honorable Chief Justice Annette Kingsman Ziegler presiding, your silence is commanded.
All right, please be seated. Calling the second case this morning, Brown versus Wisconsin Election Commission, 24AP232. Appearances, please.
Good morning, Your Honor. Chief Justice.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Scott Thompson, representing the last years for men.
Good morning. All right, good morning. The lineup I have today is 10 minutes, followed by 5 minutes, 5 minutes, and 5 minutes. It goes awfully fast. All right, and then 30 minutes, followed by 5 minutes in rebuttal. Okay, great. With that, let's get going.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and may it please the court. We've split the argument this morning by topic. I will be addressing the standing issue and brief time permitting addressing the advantage to a political party, which will be addressed in greater detail by Mr. Curtis. Mr. Brown's complaint should have been dismissed for lack of standing, independent, and separately fatal reasons. The first is a lack of injury in fact.
Lack of what?
Injury in fact, Your Honor. Where a voter alleges that his or her right to vote is impaired, that voter alleges an injury in fact sufficient to support standing.
So if Mr. Brown doesn't have standing to challenge the mobile voting units, who does?
Your Honor, the short answer is somebody who would be injured by...
Give us some examples.
Your Honor, I think it would likely be somebody who is unable to access absentee voting because of the use of the mobile voting unit. I can't envision how that would be the case, but it would need to be somebody who says, my right to vote is impaired by your choice to use the mobile voting unit.
All right, and so I think standing is an interesting issue, but somebody must have standing to bring the action. And I'm looking for some concrete examples of who those injured parties would be or some ideas of who would possibly be able to bring the action.
Your Honor, I would push back a little bit on the premise that somebody must be able to sue or to bring the action.
Say, hypothetically speaking, the mobile units are illegal, invalid, or unconstitutional. Shouldn't somebody be able to bring the action?
Your Honor, the way that the legislature has structured that type of action, if there were unlawfulness, there are procedures in the statutes that allow those actions to be brought by district attorneys, even at the petition of a citizen. So 507 and 508 are vehicles by which citizens can petition or by which a district attorney can bring the type of action to address that sort of unlawfulness. But the fact that there isn't an independent action on behalf of citizens isn't unusual in the law.
So just to follow up on that, I mean, you know, that we have two different kind of interesting senses of the way the statutes work here. But it seems to me, following up on Justice Protasiewicz's question, that very few people would be able to demonstrate a kind of injury, in fact, that would normally, you know, kind of fall, even when it comes to voting. I mean, there's always other options, you know. Unless you interpret it very broadly, like any restricted hours, is that an injury? Probably not, but I don't know. I'm not sure where you work with it. So at least under the argument that you have here, it seems to me that the vast majority of alleged election irregularity claims, which 5.061 authorizes a voter in a district to complain about, but that there would be no judicial review. Or alternatively, maybe it could be read. And again, maybe I'm wrong, but obviously this is, you know, where my mind was in the Teagan case, that it does seem to create a statutorily protected right of electors, qualified voters in a local jurisdiction to challenge a rather, you know, broad set of claims, even ones that don't affect them personally in some way, and to obtain, you know, judicial review so long as it hasn't been resolved. But am I right in conceiving of it that way? And the practical reality is the vast majority of issues are not litigatable in court. Is that probably correct?
So to be very clear, what is litigatable?
I don't know.
A good one.
So that's the word of the day. We talked about that before. I'm sorry.
Rephrase the question, please.
The actions that can be brought in court by a citizen are those actions that impair the citizen's right to vote. So I think it's important to then separate those two strands of standing that we're talking about. We're talking about first the injury in fact, and that's if a voter's right to vote or access to the ballot is impaired, that's injury in fact. That's lacking here, and that itself is one standing problem. The separate issue is whether 506 provides a statutory cause of action, whether there's statutory standing. And I think that's separate, but that's then governed by...
Are there any other statutes that you're aware of that create a right for us? I mean, you know, voting is unique, so it doesn't seem odd to me that we'd have broad authority here. But I can't. Are there other statutes where citizens have the right to complain and, you know, to an agency and command obedience to something they have no personal interest in at all, but then no right to take it any further after the agency does that? Can you think of any other statutory structure like that?
So, Your Honor, I think this is not unique to elections. This type of proceeding where an interested citizen can participate, I think we see that in the contested case statutes. I'm thinking of certain DNR.
But there, they actually have to have some interest in order to get in, though, most of the time. It's not just, I generally like parks, and therefore I want to join this park litigation, right? I mean, they actually have to have something concrete. Here, we have a statute that a voter has no real interest in the preparation of the ballot, necessarily, but here they get to complain about it. I'm not aware of anything else like that.
So the air permitting context, I think, is an example, Your Honor. So in that context, somebody can comment on a permit. You don't need an aggrievement to comment on a permit. And then there's a procedure by which a person who commented on a permit can request a contested case hearing. And that is unique or separate from the procedure by which somebody aggrieved can get a contested case hearing. So there's two pathways there, and that shows that these people who are just interested can participate but aren't necessarily aggrieved.
Are you finished?
Go ahead.
Okay. I disagree with you on your importing 227 statute or jurisprudence interpreting 227 into this case that we have here. I'm telling you this so that you can respond and let me see the light, right? I agree with your opposing counsel that 227 is irrelevant here. It's irrelevant for a number of reasons. One, I suppose, is the very different interest that's required under 227 as opposed to our longstanding jurisprudence of a trifling interest. 227 says substantial. Well, substantial isn't trifling to me. It's not applicable because for judicial review, 227.52 sets forth how you do it in a DNR case, seeking a permit, if you will. But it has the proviso at the end of 227.52 preface it says, except as otherwise provided by law. And, of course, we have the review otherwise provided by law in 556. So why are you importing 227 stuff into a case that doesn't involve 227 and where no, that I was able to find, no majority opinion imports that two-part test that applies in general to 227 review. So tell me why your opposing counsel and I am wrong, or at least tell me why he's wrong. That's a better way to...
First, Your Honor, I think accepting everything that you said, Brown still lacks standing for the lack of an injury, in fact. I think if we set aside the lack of statutory standing, if you completely disagree on the 227 analogy, there's no injury, in fact, here. And I think that is the most important takeaway in this case, is that the type of injury that we have alleged in this case, a generalized grievance about too many people voting or the election officials not following the law, that is not a cognizable injury. And that's a separate analysis and a separate standing problem from the 227 analysis. So that is an independent ground to dismiss Brown's complaint.
What does the word aggrieved mean in, is it two, in 5.08, ending up in 08? What does that word mean?
I see that my time is up, if I may, Your Honors.
Go ahead and answer that question. It's going to go doubly fast for the rest of you.
So aggrieved has a very long established understanding in the law. This court in Milwaukee, City of Milwaukee versus PSC, said aggrieved means aggrieved, not in those words, but that when aggrieved is used in the statutes, it has the same meaning in all of the statutes. And
oh,
so
I don't know. 227, I'm going to let you set down. 227, 01 says, here's the definitions, if I recall correctly, and it defines aggrieved, but at the preface it says definitions in this chapter. The definitions are limited to 227.
May I briefly respond, Your Honor? The statute definitely says that, but this court had said that definition applies every time that the statutes use the term aggrieved. And so here, when we use that same word, when we see that same word in 506, it's to have the same meaning that it does in 227 and that it does in every other judicial review statute throughout the statutes, of which there are many.
All right. Go ahead.
Thank you.
Have a seat. Thank you.
Morning, Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. I'm Racine City Attorney Scott Letney. I represent the defendant appellant, Racine City Clerk Tara McMenamin, who is here with us today. And I'm here to speak in support of Clerk McMenamin's use of a mobile election unit as an alternate absentee ballot site, mobile election unit also known as the MEU. Initially, I want to address what I consider the derisive use of the word van in some of the briefing to describe this vehicle. This is a very large vehicle. It's not a van like you'd get from your local car dealer. It's the size of a recreational vehicle or a bus that is completely accessible. It's wide open. It has permanently affixed tables, places that people can request ballots, can vote ballots, and return ballots. Honestly, it's larger inside than many of the offices I've had in my career as a government attorney.
Is it a public building?
It's not a public building.
What do you do with 5.25? Polling places shall be in public buildings unless the use of a public building is impracticable, or the use of a non-public building better serves the needs of the electorate.
Yes, ma'am. I recognize that 525 says that. And 525 specifically relates to polling places, which are the places that elections are conducted on election day. The alternate absentee ballot sites, the in-person absentee voting procedures, fall under Chapter 6. And specifically, the sites are defined by 6.855. And there's nothing in that statute that talks about a public building. And frankly, as Justice Hagedorn acknowledged in the concurring opinion in Trump versus Biden, an alternate absentee voting site is a location where a person may request a ballot, may vote a ballot, and may return a ballot. There is nothing more in that statutory scheme, and certainly nothing that can be read as requiring it be held in a building or a public building.
Under your argument, counsel, it really doesn't matter how spacious these units are, or vans, whatever you want to call them, because under your argument, if I'm understanding it correctly, a clerk has the discretion to choose a van, correct?
Well, I think there would be a question of accessibility. There has to be accessibility.
And so, if the van were accessible, that would be okay, even if it wasn't spacious like the MEUs, maybe.
If a van were accessible and it was at a location and a person could request a ballot, vote a ballot, and return a ballot, that could serve as an alternate absentee ballot site. Yes, ma'am.
Other than accessibility, what other limits are there, statutorily or otherwise, under your argument, on the clerk's selection of places where people can cast their absentee or early voting ballot?
So if I understand your question, it's about the locations, not the use of the structure of the MEU, where the alternate absentee ballot sites are located. Statutorily, under 6.855, a municipality can have more than one site, and they just need to be as near as practicable to the clerk's office, which in this case is in City Hall, and practicability is frankly a wide open definition. It can be anywhere that's accessible, that's equitable, that people can get to and they can use, they know exists, and in fact is a location where a person may request a ballot, vote a ballot, and return a ballot.
So it could be a table on a college campus, it could be a table in a park. There's no statutory restrictions on that type of site.
Sure. In theory, it could be any of those kinds of places.
There's, of course, the notice requirement, too, though, correct?
Of course, there is a notice.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm sorry. There is a Type E notice that has to be published at least 14 days before the beginning of the in-person absentee voting period, so that has to be done. There are requirements. But as far as selecting a place, I think the clerk has broad discretion. She's one of the, I think it's called, a small army of local election officials that has to conduct elections in this state.
And just to be clear, there's nothing in that statute 6.855 that says building, which is different than 5.25?
25.
Which is different than 5.25, correct?
Correct, ma'am. Yes.
It says site.
Yes, it just says site. There is no requirement that the alternate absentee ballot site be a physical building, as we've said. I can briefly address the issue of party advantage, and other parties will do that, but I just believe that the clerk has, sorry, I have, see, my time is finished. May I?
You can finish your sentence if you'd like to. You don't have to. You're welcome to.
Thank you. Well, I'll leave party advantage to other parties.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
Chief Justice Ziegler, and may it please the court, I'd like to make three key points about the advantage to any political party issue in the limited time I have. Point number one, a major basis for the circuit court's conclusion on this issue was that Weck's decision was procedurally deficient because it had improperly disregarded an unopposed statistical study submitted by Brown. Those are the circuit court's words. But that's wrong. The Racine clerk did oppose this statistical study on multiple grounds, factual and legal. See record 57. Weck cataloged those grounds of opposition in its decision. See Weck appendix at 31. And Weck determined that the clerk had submitted compelling arguments as to the inaccuracy of Brown's data study and misapplication of the statutes. The Circuit Court's decision about political party advantage must be rejected for this reason alone. Second, that study is deeply flawed in its conception, its execution, and its conclusions. As this Court emphasized in its stay decision last June, the statute doesn't even mention wards at all, but early voting sites. Those are what we analyze. The appellant's briefs on our side catalog many additional flaws, factual and legal, which I will discuss if time permits, but I want to emphasize a third critical point. As this Court also observed in its stay decision, Brown's arguments cannot be reconciled with the reasoning in One Wisconsin, which led directly, and I don't think there's any dispute about this, led directly to the enactment of subsection 5, permitting multiple absentee voting sites.
Counsel, why, I mean, all due respect to our coordinate federal courts, but why do we care about a federal district court decision? We are not bound by it. It was a particular factual finding. It was not reviewed on appeal. I understand the statute's since been amended. But just because a federal district court engaged in some reasoning based upon a particular factual record, that doesn't bind us in any way. We don't need to conform ourselves to it. I suppose we should be mindful of the Voting Rights Act issues in this, but we owe no deference to it. It's a totally different case under a factual record, again, unreviewed. Why should that govern us or guide our analysis in this case?
Well, Justice Hagedorn, I think the statutory history of subsection 5, as reviewed by the Circuit Court, shows that the purpose of subsection 5 was to resolve the federal illegality.
Totally agree, but that doesn't really change what we do when we're just reading the text as it's enacted. But it matters that they were trying to avoid the issues that were deemed unconstitutional in the federal district court, but I still don't understand why we need to look at it, one federal district court's reasoning, and conform, bend our reasoning to work around that. I mean, it just doesn't seem relevant to what we're trying to do here.
Well, Justice Hagedorn, if we agree that the motivating factor behind the enactment of subsection 5 was to address and resolve the difficulties in One Wisconsin, it seems to me we at least ought to identify what those difficulties were. And there were two that One Wisconsin addressed. One was the risk of crowding and long lines if there are not enough early voting sites. But the second reason is distance, the distance that many voters must travel to reach a centralized early voting site. The district court in One Wisconsin emphasized the difficulties for voters who lack access to transportation, that voters must travel further. The Seventh Circuit emphasized, and I'm not suggesting this is binding, but give it whatever weight you think is due, but the Seventh Circuit, in a decision by Judge Easterbrook, emphasized with respect to the one location rule, the opportunity to participate may decrease as distance increases. Brown only addresses the first concern.
Just one
the crowding.
One other follow-up, if I could, on a different issue, given how short time is. WEC's decision I found a little perplexing and punting on. It kind of said, hey, we don't know what partisan or political party advantage means, so hopefully courts will tell us. What are we supposed to do with that? And one thing I was struggling with is it didn't feel like anybody put forward a kind of coherent theory other than theirs is wrong. I understand that argument, but what's the theory of when it is violated?
Well, the way I would approach it, Your Honor, would be to look at what the city's articulated justifications for its sites were. Here, the city used, among other sites, neighborhood libraries. I think fire stations were identified at least as possible sites, and a number of other places. Those are politically neutral areas that certainly aren't chosen. Say a library is not chosen because, you know, it's near Democrats or Republicans. It's chosen to service the public. And so if the city comes forward with evidence that it has attempted using neutral criteria to serve as many people as possible and deal with that distance problem that One Wisconsin talked about, the distance issue, then I think, first of all, a reviewing court needs to give some deference to the local government. Priorities, discuss that at some length. Local governments know their communities better than circuit judges or WEC or certainly this court, and so they deserve some deference. But if someone disagrees and can come forward with evidence of a political advantage, political party advantage, they can file a 5.06 complaint with WEC, and then WEC can apply its expertise and judgment, which do deserve due weight. And then if someone disagrees with that, they can appeal beyond. It is a case, and WEC emphasized, this is a case-by-case determination. It is hard to enunciate a formula that says this is going to take care of the, you know, any conceivable advantage to a political party. I don't think that's possible. It really is fact-specific. It turns on local circumstances, and it's a decision best made in the first instance by the local government itself. I see I've...
Chief Justice, may I ask a follow-up question?
Yes. Go ahead.
If the clerk's decision-making in this case with respect to the mobile election units or anything else didn't confer a benefit or an advantage on the Democratic Party, then why are you here? You represent the Democratic National Committee, correct?
Yes.
So
yes.
What is your interest in the litigation? As I understand it, when you filed a motion to intervene, you asserted that the Democratic Party or the Democratic National Committee had a strong interest, I'm paraphrasing now, in this litigation because it would interfere, now I'm quoting, with DNC's core mission of supporting the election of Democratic candidates.
Yes.
So are you suggesting then that a decision finding or determining that the clerk did not act in accordance with the law would hurt Democratic candidates?
Because Brown's argument that you can have as many voting sites as you want, but they all have to be, you know, crowded right around the courthouse in only one ward. Racine has 49 wards. They can be located in only one ward. Is going to disadvantage, you know, all voters, it seems to me, but it certainly has a disadvantageous effect on Democratic voters as well. It seems to me our interest, and it ought to be all parties' interest, ought to be in making voting as broad and accessible as possible in all of a municipality's wards. So, you know, I don't think that a victory for us here is going to, you know, bestow some, you know, advantage on the Democratic Party. It's going to bestow an advantage on voters.
You asserted that it would confer a disadvantage. It would disadvantage Democratic voters or candidates. It would disadvantage the Democratic Party if this court were to say that the clerk's choices with respect to mobile election units and alternate sites were overturned.
Because, again, if early voting sites have to be packed into one single ward, that's going to make it much, much more difficult and sometimes impossible for our constituents and our voters to get to that ward, you know, to find transportation. So, yes, it's going to disadvantage our voters, but I think equally Republicans as well.
Chief, can I ask a question, or do you want to stop?
Sure.
Okay. Can I ask you, I want to ask you a question about 6855 sub 1 and going sort of along the lines of what Justice Rebecca Bradley was talking about. What the statute says is that no site may be designated that affords an advantage to a political party. Are you drawing a distinction between political party and partisan advantage? And if so, how should that be framed?
Well, that's a great question, Your Honor. Because the short of it is, I'm not sure what the difference is. We have focused on the statutory language, advantage to a political party. We think that controls. That's statutory construction 101. Now, Brown has argued for a partisan advantage a standard. It's always been a bit unclear to me what that means and what the difference is, but Brown has pushed for it very hard and doesn't want to be stuck to a political party advantage. The RNC, in its amicus brief, I think also raised the question of, you know, we're not sure there is necessarily any difference. So maybe it's just in the eye of the beholder, Justice Karofsky, but I vote with the plain language of the statute, advantage to a political party.
Money political party. Okay. Thank you. Thanks, Chief.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Shorter than Chuck.
I think on the, is it the right side for you? Maybe, yeah.
There we go.
Okay.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. We have one simple message today. Voting is a right, not a privilege. Because Wisconsin Statute 6.84 violates this principle, it is likely unconstitutional, and therefore this court should avoid construing 6.855 with 6.84.
Did the circuit court consider the constitutionality? I thought the constitutional issues you raised were not raised in the circuit court and have not been fully developed.
Your Honor, the circuit court brought up Section 6.84, and the issue really crystallized thereafter. And so we are bringing this issue to the court's attention as a matter of extreme precaution because of the right to vote's preeminence. There are really two ways that Statute 6.84 comes up against or violates the right to vote as understood in Wisconsin. First, in its initial subsection, where it specifically reads that voting by absentee ballot is a privilege. That language is in direct tension with the notion of the right to vote in Wisconsin.
Just a question to help frame this issue here. It feels to me like judging 101 is we don't like delete words from statute. We don't amend them. And so what we can do is we can enjoin officials from exercising, you know, what a statute says in some way. So the idea that a declaration of policy would be something that one would strike as unconstitutional just feels totally foreign to judging in terms of what we do. So it feels to me like it would have to be something in relation to either somebody acting or you think it can't guide it, or you think it has that statement of policy has particular pertinence to how we read the statutes, though this court said priorities, maybe not. And so if priorities is correct, I'm not sure how that point is even before us.
Well, Your Honor, let me respond in a couple of ways. I think that the second subsection of 6.84 is clearly colored by the first subsection. I think it is true that priorities really helped clarify that subsection 1 is a declaration of policy. But I think because subsection 1 colors the second subsection, the issue is still sort of inexorably intertwined with how we think about Section 6.84.
I've just never heard of a court declaring a statement of policy unconstitutional. I just don't even know what that means.
Well, perhaps this would be helpful to Your Honor. We are not specifically seeking declaratory relief in this case. Again, this issue crystallized when the lower court applied 6.84 to 6.855. Again, our message today is primarily that 6.855 should not be intermingled, if you will, with Section 6.84. In our briefs, there's a handful of reasons why, but one of those reasons is because 6.84 is unconstitutional. In other words, this court can operate to avoid constitutional problems by making sure that 6.855's construction is not imbued somehow with Section 6.84.
Do you think if it didn't use those words, you would still? What I read it to say is that everybody has a constitutional right to vote, and so there's sort of standard ways we provide that vote. But if we're going to do something that is a little riskier as far as security of the polling place, right, then we're going to add some more guardrails around that. And let's say it said that in maybe more formal language. It didn't use this, privilege language here. Would you still be making the same argument, or do you think that's a permissible thing for the legislature to say about its own law it wrote, and for it to say, and by the way, that should matter for you because we're concerned about the fact that it is less safe in our judgment, which seems to be what the legislature said.
So, Your Honor, I think the legislature certainly has the right to regulate absentee voting. We're not trying to suggest that isn't the case. And in fact, the statutes really do that. However, the language really is the problem. It is a problem that the statute says voting by absentee ballot is a privilege. That is an issue. And perhaps if the statutes didn't have that language, that piece wouldn't have a constitutional problem. I see my time has ended. I have just one final point. That would not save the second subsection, because the past tense language in the second subsection that suggests that absentee voters' ballots that have already been cast or have already been counted may not be counted because they just depart in a small fashion from those statutes, that is inconsistent with how this court has understood the right to vote in relationship to absentee ballots for over 100 years and how it should apply it in this case. Thank you.
Thought you might get a few more, but I guess not. Okay. All right. Thank you.
I think it's my turn.
Yes, it is.
And thankfully, Scott and I are about the same height. Good morning, and may it please the court. Lucas Weber for the plaintiff respondent, cross appellant, Ken Brown. In addition to the standing question that was raised by some of the appellants here, there are five issues on the merits pending before the court, two in the appeal and three in the cross appeal. All five issues stem from the same facts regarding the clerk of the City of Racine's administration of in-person absentee voting during the August 2022 primary election.
So if we would agree with you on one of those five, would we have to decide all five?
No, Your Honor, I don't think you would. You could reverse Weck's decision on just one of those five. We would ask that the court still address all five. We think they're important issues that would still be worthy of the court's attention. The first two issues deal with the location of the sites that were selected for in-person absentee voting. The statutes require that those sites be as near as practicable to the office of the municipal clerk and that they afford no advantage to a political party.
Counsel, if we would decide that there is no standing, then some may suggest that, okay, then that's it, no standing. let's say we go further. And address some, but not all, of these two on appeal and three cross appeal. Rank them in the order of priority that you want us to address.
Yeah, Your Honor, I think first would be the use of the mobile election unit. Second would be the nearness requirement, the as near as practicable. And then closely related to that is the political party advantage requirement. And then the remaining two issues which are whether the sites remained in effect until at least the day after the election, and then whether or not the clerk's continued use of the City Hall as a location violated the requirement that when an alternate site is used, no functions related to absentee voting continue to occur in the clerk's office.
Thank you.
But I would concede that if we don't have standing, that itself would be fatal to me today.
Please,
so
I want to ask you a question about standing, perhaps more than one. My understanding from the record is that your client, Mr. Brown, witnessed early in-person absentee voting at two places. One was the clerk's office, and the second was a van when it was parked at the Regency Mall location.
Yes, Your Honor.
And those, your client saw both those on the same day. I'm having a hard time understanding how your client was injured in fact by witnessing. It seems he might be one step removed from.
Your Honor, so 5.061 allows Brown, who is an elector, to file a complaint because he believed that his election official was acting contrary to the law. That's what 5.061 allows for. No party has contested that Brown didn't have the ability to file that complaint, or that they never suggested that he improperly filed that complaint with WEC. So the only question then is whether he was able to appeal WEC's dismissal of that complaint. Under 5.06(8), as has been discussed, any complainant who is aggrieved by an order issued under sub 6, here it was WEC's dismissal order, may appeal the decision of the commission to the circuit court. This issue was very recently resolved by a published opinion of the Court of Appeals in Hess versus WEC. In that case, WEC argued, as they do here, that the complainant who filed the complaint there lacked standing to appeal when their complaint was dismissed because they were not aggrieved. The Court of Appeals decided the issue very simply. They rejected the argument, and they held that the statute plainly states where a complainant, quote, having filed a verified complaint with WEC, as Brown did here, and having received an unfavorable decision from WEC, clearly meets the qualifications of the statute as a complainant aggrieved by WEC's decision.
I want to summarize what I'm hearing you saying, and I'm sure you'll correct me if I'm wrong. So is it your position that any time a party files a complaint with the Wisconsin Elections Commission and then loses, that that party under 5.06 has the right to appeal to a court just by losing, that makes them aggrieved?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's what 5.06(8) contends. Yeah.
No matter what. I'm just thinking about there was a hypothetical, and this is on page 21 of WEC's reply or response brief. It came to us as a third brief. There were a lot of briefs here. I'll tell you what it is. Okay. It says it imagines a voter who mistakenly believes that state law requires elections officials to throw away all ballots that includes votes for a particular party. So it's taking this to perhaps an extreme example, yes?
Sure.
While the belief is patently inaccurate, there's no doubt that the belief would allow the voter to file a complaint under 5.06(1). So under your view, even in this, we'd agree it's an extreme example, even there, if that person lost in front of the Wisconsin Elections Commission, they would be aggrieved, and they could file their lawsuit in circuit court.
Yes, Your Honor, I do believe they would. I think the special proceeding that's created by sub 8 to review WEC's decisions would allow for that. I think there are other things that would come into play there. I mean, frivolous lawsuits get filed all the time and would be subject to, you know, other penalties, I suppose, and ethics rules there. So if you know, frivolous complaints were being filed and frivolous complaints were being brought in circuit court, you know, presumably there'd be other remedies. Presuming, of course, that this would be a frivolous argument they're making on the extreme. So, but I do think that Section 8 would allow any party. It simply says the aggrieved party, and I think in that context, it just means whichever party loses before WEC, and that's what the Court of Appeals said in Hess. I'm sorry.
So there's 1,852 clerks in municipalities overseen by 72 elected county clerks. So under your theory, any voter, any time, based on their belief, which could include just standing there watching someone vote, make whatever their belief is about what happened, they can not only bring it to WEC, but they can bring it to the court, and it then is subject to the court process. Any yep. voter, there's no guardrails at all on what you're proposing, correct?
Your Honor, I think Section 5.06 sub 1, which creates the ability to file with WEC, is kind of the first filter, but I think that confers very broad ability on any elector to file the complaint.
Right, but it says nothing about appealing it other than using a word aggrieved, which under your reading, you really don't need the word aggrieved. You basically just can appeal it. It doesn't, I mean, aggrieved has no meaning in the version that you're telling us.
Yeah, and I think that's consistent with what the Court of Appeals found in the Hess case.
I understand that has happened since this case was filed, but that's what you're advocating to us, that we read out the word aggrieved, that we allow this statute to stand for the proposition that any voter, any time, not only has the right to take this to WEC, something they believe, that they can then take that case if they lose and file a lawsuit.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think, this is evidenced, that reading of the statute is evidenced by what would happen if an election official were to lose. WEC would have determined that they violated the law. They certainly couldn't claim they were aggrieved because they violated the law, and they would then not be able to bring a complaint under the statute, right? Because where would their agreement
well,
come
they
from
would,
in that case?
Wait, that's confusing because you're saying they would bring something to under 5.06 sub 1, any voter, and I get that's what 5.06 sub 1 says, any voter can, it's a low bar, it's what you believe, right? Where else
yes,
do we
sir.
Have that kind of low bar other than in an election statute, which makes sense with WEC, but you're then taking it that next step, which takes out any kind of personal injury to the person.
Your Honor, I think that's the policy choice that the legislature made here when they created this proceeding to review WEC's decisions, and our task today is simply to give that meaning. I think Brown clearly has standing to bring this complaint under Hess, and because he has been aggrieved, because his complaint was dismissed.
Why do we have the WEC layer at all? Why doesn't the person filing the complaint go straight to the circuit court?
Because I think it gets to some of the other issues, and I think perhaps that's where WEC is confusing standing to bring a general declaratory judgment action in circuit court, which is not what we've done here. We brought a special administrative appeal of WEC's decision. WEC does the fact-finding. The record is the record produced by WEC. And then it goes to the circuit court, which reviews the legal argument. That's what 5.06 requires on appeal.
But just to clarify, I think your position is that under 5.06 sub 1 that it's not any elector anywhere can challenge any action of any election official. It's an elector of a jurisdiction can challenge the actions of election officials in their jurisdiction, right? So it's really voter specific and local election officials that are being talked about here.
Yes, Your Honor, that's an important distinction, and thank you.
And your standing, are you done?
Yeah.
Your standing argument is just based on 5.06, which is to say, I don't hear you adopting the language from Teagan, which talked about the pollution theory of standing, which said basically that where an elector would have standing to challenge certain election procedures that they believed would, quote-unquote, pollute the integrity of the result. I don't hear
correct,
you adopting that, but I just want to make sure that I'm
correct. Yeah, Your Honor, correct. We have not at any point in this litigation argued for vote dilution or claimed that we have standing because of that.
And you also, I'm going to guess, maybe I shouldn't, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley asked questions about 227 standing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you are looking at all at Friends of Black River Forest and adopting any of the standing analysis from the framework that was set forth in that case.
Correct, Your Honor. As Justice Bradley had explained earlier, we don't believe that Chapter 227 and Chapter 506 are the same. We don't believe that the standing analysis under Chapter 7 applies to 5.06. I will say that the Court of Appeals in Hess did apply Friends of Black River Falls to the 5.06 challenge there, and that's when they determined that it had standing. But I think there are many reasons that the statutes differentiate between each other.
you know, 5.069 only incorporates the standards of review for agencies under 227.57. 227.03 sub 6 says specifically that orders of the Election Commission under Section 5.066 are not subject to this chapter. You know, I think there are a variety of textual reasons that indicate they were intended to be separate. And, of course, the term person aggrieved, which is used under Chapter 227, is not the same as a complainant who is aggrieved under 5.06. That is a term of art that is specifically defined in Chapter 227 and does not apply to 5.06.
So, counsel, this election was in 2022, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
It was a primary election, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So how would partisan advantage be impacted in a primary?
Well, votes still occur. People still get out to vote. If it makes it easier for members of one party to go vote in the primary versus members in another party to go vote in the primary, that political party is still benefited because their voters had an easier time voting. Which gets me to the first two merits issues under Section 5.06's requirement that those locations, the sites, be as near as practicable to the municipal clerk's office and that they afford no advantage to a political party.
I just want to go back. I've got one more question about this primary election. I didn't see anywhere in the briefs that you allege that Mr. Brown actually voted in that election. Is that correct?
I don't know if the record reflects that, actually, Your Honor.
Okay.
Counsel, as you try to segue, I'm going to stop you.
Yeah. Thank you. To understand, to
no, I am going to start.
Give me your honor. I apologize.
You have an impossible job. I'm sorry.
Two things. Number one, boy, I thought this all boiled down to, not all, but it boiled down to the standing issue, how you define aggrieved in sub 8. But after the exchange with you and Justice Dallet, it sounds like the word aggrieved may be almost superfluous, because why would anyone appeal? You know, it's not a useless exercise. They appeal because they don't agree with something. So maybe what I thought was the essence of the standing argument, how do you define aggrieved, falls by the wayside. That's my first question. I do have a second question, but let's start with that. Does aggrieve, is that a meaningless word? Is it surplusage here? Because why else would you appeal?
Yeah, Your Honor, and I apologize if I created some confusion with how I explained it. Aggrieved does have meaning. Aggrieved means it's the party who loses before whack. I mean, it recognizes the longstanding principle in the law that the party who wins doesn't get to appeal. And that's how we explained it in the briefing. And I think
that's exactly the way you explained it. And I just saw a little erosion of that. Now, I may agree or disagree with your definition of aggrieved, but let's say I disagree. And but I want to get to some of these other issues. What's the analysis of saying no standing, but nevertheless we're addressing questions? What's the hook to be doing that?
Your Honor, I think you were asking if the court were to find that we don't have standing to bring these claims, can the court still proceed and resolve any of these issues?
Yes, that's a better statement of my question.
I don't know if you could, but if you're willing to, I think it would be beneficial to the voters of Wisconsin and to the government entities to resolve these issues, certainly. But I think if the court were to determine that we don't have standing to be here today, I don't think our claims could be heard.
You don't think so? I was looking at a case, so much fun, State versus Schumacher, and former Chief Justice Heffernan wrote it. And he has a very robust view of the court's power of the scope of judicial review. And he speaks in that case about, you know, even if we don't have standing, he makes reference to that, that we can still advance the case and address issues of great public interest. He said, we can reach issues, for instance, that are moot, but nevertheless of great public importance. We've said we will reach issues of great public importance even when the parties would not ordinarily have standing to raise the issue. Yes? No?
Your Honor, we didn't brief that question at all before the court, but again, I think if the court is still willing to reach these issues, I think it certainly should.
One more quick question on standing. What do we do with all of our cases that require at least a trifling interest?
The interest is here, Your Honor. I mean, the interest is granted under 5.06.
So you find the interest in the statute itself, just the mere fact that the statute exists. You don't think there also needs to be some kind of injury in fact?
Your Honor, I think the 5.06 creates this process, the complaint process before WEC. It gives WEC the ability to hear these complaints, to do fact-finding, to issue orders to resolve the complaints, and then it creates an appeals process to create the special proceeding that you can then get to before a judge to review the decision of the state agency. I think that process itself confers standing, and you are injured, any party is injured in fact, when their complaint is dismissed and they can't get relief under that process before WEC. If WEC wrongly dismisses their complaint or misinterprets a statute, and then dismisses a complaint, as Brown has alleged here occurred, then his only recourse is to go to circuit court and have that reversed. I'll move on to the as near as practicable language. I think the requirement in statute is best understood in the context in which it was created. Up until the late 90s, Wisconsin law required a reason to vote absentee. In 1999, the legislature amended the law to go to no-fault absentee voting. You could vote for essentially any reason. As a result of that, there was an influx in voting via absentee, and it became interested in allowing a site outside of the municipal clerk's office to vote at, an alternate in-person absentee voting site. When the legislature then created 6.855, which allowed absentee voting to occur at these alternate sites, it included the restrictions that the sites be as near as practicable to the municipal clerk's office and that they not afford an advantage to any political party. And the reason for doing so is obvious. They were concerned that when a site was moved out of the traditional neutrality of the clerk's office, that partisan games would be played and that the location...
Can I ask, is your argument that having an alternative voting site out anywhere outside the ward of where the clerk's office is would violate the statute unless there's some other ward that under some sort of analysis has the same type of partisan breakdown? Is that where you land?
Your Honor, I think I think you could have one outside as long as it was as near as practical and did not afford an advantage to a political party, which is a nuanced answer, I understand. But I think what the ward analysis does is it makes it easy on clerks, right? You're required to not afford an advantage to a political party. That necessarily requires some sort of look at the political makeup of the location where the site is going to be. There's no other way to read that provision of the statute.
I understand I'm conflating two of your issues. I appreciate you going along with that. I want to ask you a couple questions about the ward. So there isn't anything in 6.885 that talks about assessing ward-level voting behavior, right?
There is not.
And,
correct.
And it doesn't say, there's nothing in that statute also that says the clerk's office is supposed to be the benchmark for any alternative voting sites. I understand that the ward data is available, and perhaps that's why you relied on it. But it seems like really imprecise to me for a number of reasons. You know, wards can change, and they do change, and the wards that we're seeing have changed between the time of the data that you have, which I believe is just before 2000, and they changed after 2022, which again is, it went from 36, I believe, to 49-ish. I think from 36 to 49 wards in that time. Wards move,
yes,
I guess,
sir.
What I'm saying. The timing doesn't seem right here. And the third thing I'll throw out, and I know Justice Portisay was asked this, is it is hard for me to wrap my head around this it was a nonpartisan election. I'm sorry, it was a partisan primary, so partisanship did not matter. for all those reasons, I have a real hard time with the arguments around your ward analyses.
Yeah, and thank you, Your Honor, for the question. I think it gets again to why that provision was put in there in the first instance, right? It was the legislature's concern that an in-person absentee ballot site located outside of the municipal clerk's office would afford or would be used to play games, placed in a location that made it easy for members of one political party to vote, members of other political parties more difficult to vote, right? That's the obvious concern and why it was added into the statute, just from the plain language of the statute itself. But the only way then to resolve that concern or to give that concern any meaning in that text in the statute is to look at the partisan makeup, the political makeup of the site where the in-person absentee voting site would be located. And the only way to do that at the local level is to look at ward data. That's the only way votes are broken down.
Don't you end up disadvantaging certain people? And I'm thinking about there's on page 22 of Block's brief, they talk about the city of Milwaukee. So I'm worried that we're disadvantaging certain voters, right? Voters who have a hard time getting to the polls, who have to work late. I mean, according to Block, the city of Milwaukee, and I'm on page 22 if you're trying to flip to it, the city of Milwaukee in the 2022 general election voted for governor. The ward in which Milwaukee's Board of Election Commissioners is located, which is Ward 1414, they saw 394 votes cast for Democratic candidate Tony Evers and 294 cast for Republican candidate Tim Michaels. And then they asked how many of Milwaukee's 354 wards had that same partisan makeup, and it's zero. So under the analysis that you're putting forward, only Ward 141 could hold an alternative site, which would mean everyone else in Milwaukee would only be able to access alternate voting if they went to Ward 141, which kind of throws out the whole idea of having easy early voting and making voting accessible for many, many people.
A couple of responses to that, Your Honor. First, the city of Milwaukee data was not part of what WEC considered when they heard this case. It's not officially part of the record.
Yeah, and
understood.
As an example, I don't even know if these numbers are right. It almost doesn't matter.
The data that is in the record on Racine provides similar results. There are no wards with identical makeup. But
fair enough.
I think that gets to a little bit into the One Wisconsin arguments that were being made earlier. There was the quote, the quote that was given, the opportunity to participate may decrease as distance increases, but the quote was incomplete. He cut off the next line of, yet Milwaukee clerk's office is centrally located. So the Seventh Circuit gave some indication that they actually didn't think that it would have been there, and I don't know, what the analysis would have been because the issue was moot, but in analyzing those particular challenges, certainly cast some serious doubt on the One Wisconsin opinion. Now, I think what the legislature was trying to do was say that, hey, the default voting location is always the clerk's office. I think everybody agrees with that. That's what the statute says. When you move it out of the clerk's office and go somewhere else, that somewhere else has to be as near as practicable to the clerk's office, and it cannot afford an advantage to a political party. So the easiest way to do that is, of course, to keep it in the same ward. If it's in the same ward, it would not confer any political advantage or any advantage to a political party, and it would always be as near as practicable.
Okay, and let me push back on that a little bit. You made an assumption that somehow it benefits the political party of the people that make up the ward in the most numbers by putting an alternate site there, but isn't it true that people work in other wards? They run errands in other wards. Mm-hmm. They pass a ward on the way to work.
Yes, sir.
Democrats and Republicans. And so how can you just make this presumption that having another site in their ward is somehow going to benefit anybody? It could hurt Republicans. It could hurt Democrats. It doesn't make sense to me what you're saying, that you have to all lump them into the one ward where the clerk's office is. That doesn't seem to correlate in any meaningful way with giving access based on some kind of political party is advantaged or disadvantaged. I just don't understand that connection.
Your Honor, I think it's, first of all, it's immaterial if they could go vote anywhere. The question is, does the site location make it easier for voters of one party or another to vote for,
and
right?
And does it so make it easier to have them all in one place if you work in another ward, you are passing another ward on your way, you're on the border of two wards? How does it make it easier just by sticking another one there?
If the clerk had said, for example, that every ward that has 99% Democrats will get an in-person absentee ballot site, and every ward that doesn't have 99% Democrats doesn't get an in-person...
Is that what happened here, though? Didn't Racine spread them
all over?
No,
Your Honor,
but
I think... But on the whole, as the analysis that's in the record concludes, on the whole, the sites did benefit one political party over
based on that analysis, which is so statistically questionable, we won't even go there. But my point is, you are correct that in a certain case, you might be able to prove what you're saying. But in this case, isn't it true that these sites were all over the city? So in theory, someone could, driving to work in some other place, vote.
Yes, but spreading the sites all throughout the city violates the other principle of the statute that they must be as near as practicable to the clerk's office. And the as near as language has to be given meaning. It can't just be completely meaningless. My colleague from Racine argued earlier, that the practicable language essentially means anything. That can't be. As near as has to mean something. Geography has to be the primary factor. First, you find a site that's as near as it can be to the clerk's office. Then you determine if it's practicable to have the absentee voting site there or multiple sites. You go through the process as many times as you'd like.
Counsel, I'd like to return to a trifling interest. In response to the question of what trifling interest is there here, you responded that the trifling interest is found, the trifling interest for standing is found in 5.06. I thought your answer would have been that the trifling interest for standing is in the review section of sub 8 because you are aggrieved. So why is it under 06.1, as I understood your response to be?
Your Honor, I think the interest is created by sub 1. The interest here in my client's ensuring that his local election official is conforming the conduct to the law. The harm, the aggrievement to that interest comes from sub 8 when that complaint was dismissed, allowing for the appeal.
So where is your injury? Need an injury? In your analysis? And
yeah,
so where do you focus your injury?
Well, I think the injury here is that is his harm that's caused when his complaint is dismissed, and because WEC has applied in our argument an improper interpretation of the law.
It has nothing to do with the MVUs. His harm isn't created by the MVUs, or his harm isn't created by the fact that there are these multiple voting sites that are outside of the war. You're saying that he is aggrieved, that he is harmed because WEC ruled against him?
So his injury is to first get before WEC, the interest that's harmed that he filed his complaint based on was the illegal use of the mobile election unit, which I'd like to get to in a minute. But the harm to bring the appeal was that he was aggrieved when his complaint was dismissed. And that's what the statute requires. And again, that's what the Court of Appeals found in Hess.
Just to follow up on this partisan advantage, political party advantage thing, if you were writing a holding in this case, as we might do if we address this question, a clerk places these alternate sites for partisan advantage when they... What? Fill in the blank for us.
Your Honor, my red light's on. May I answer the question?
Please do. It's kind of been open today.
So, Your Honor, I'm sorry. I think we would ask this court to reverse WEC's decision and to provide with the partisan advantage when the location that's selected affords an advantage to a political party, comparing that location to the clerk's office. I think that's the...
Okay, so the judicial sort of construction, the test you're asking us to adopt, because, you know, we've got some vague language, we've got to make sense of it, you need some sort of way to evaluate it.
Yeah.
The test is, that you're asking us to adopt, that this language means and is best read as and should be evaluated as for us and for executive branch officials who have to deal with this, is they need to look at the ward-specific data, and it needs to be either in the same ward or equivalent in order to not run afoul of this provision.
Yes, Your Honor, but again, Brown's reading of the statute is the only one that accords meaning to all words in the statute and actually makes it quite easy on the clerk. The clerk doesn't have to engage in that ward-level data if they just locate the alternate sites in the same ward that the clerk's office is. That would be as near as practicable, and it wouldn't afford an advantage to a political party, and it would make life easy. Thank you.
Is it possible to hear his best argument on mobile vans and why they're not?
I think that was a question. Can you make your best
thank
argument?
You.
Yes, Your Honor. I would be happy to, and thank you for the opportunity.
Best means more.
The use of the van is unlawful, and it's unlawful for three reasons. First, the text and context of the statute makes clear that only fixed physical buildings are intended to be used as sites. Second, it's impossible to square the use of the van with the requirements under the statute for storing ballots and chain of custody requirements. And third, relatedly, there's no way to maintain a consistent definition of site across all the relevant absentee voting statutes while also allowing the use of a van. If you only want my best argument, I guess I'll give you the statutory text. 5.25 establishes that polling places shall be public buildings unless the use of a public building for this purpose is impracticable or the use of non-public building better serves the needs of the electorate. That is not limited to polling places on election day.
But that's a polling place. Can I ask another question?
That's what I was going to follow up.
Yeah. Can we just let him try to finish what he wanted to say, and you are next up to ask him.
Thank you, Chief.
And you don't necessarily have to talk really fast.
Understood,
you can talk slower than Justice Hagedorn. that's quite a scene.
Your Honor, perhaps anticipating your question, a polling place is simply defined under the statute as the actual location wherein the electors' vote is cast. And I think that definition of polling place actually supports the idea that a polling place has to be in a building. It says wherein, not where at or at which. It's wherein. Wherein implies a building. You're in a building.
Right, so this is my pushback on that. Are you done? Sorry. That's polling place. That's where I go on the day of the election to vote. This case is about the alternate voting sites where I go to vote before the election as an alternate site that is not a 5.25 site. And one says building, and one doesn't have building in it. Just a site. So I'm having a hard time applying the 525 definition onto the definition in Chapter 6.
Yeah, Your Honor, and I would argue that all in-person absentee sites are also polling locations. They meet that definition under the statute as a place where votes are cast. But I think the other textual clues also make clear beyond just the 5.25. For example, under 6.88, when a ballot arrives at either the office of the municipal clerk or an alternate site, if applicable, and here they were applicable, the ballot has to be sealed in an envelope. Instructions get printed on the envelope that say it shall not be open until it's counted. I'm paraphrasing, obviously. And once sealed in the envelope, the statute requires that the clerk, quote, shall keep the ballot in the clerk's office or at the alternate site, if applicable, until delivered to the individuals who will count them. It's impossible to square the use of the mobile van with that statutory requirement because they're not keeping the ballots in the van. It's undisputed. The clerk has admitted that she brought them into her office to store them, right? You don't store the ballots in the van. And that gets to the other problems with it, that, for example, the sites that were actually noticed weren't even the sites that were used. The site noticed a church, noticed the beach. Voting didn't occur in the church or at the beach. It occurred in the van, which was parked nearby. The statute contemplates, you know, you notice buildings that you would go to. I think 7.41, 1 and 2 require that within an alternate site, observation is allowed within 3 to 8 feet. You know, certainly within a van, 3 to 8 feet might be difficult to be there. I think that certainly implies that a building would. I think all of these textual clues viewed together certainly indicate that the legislature required that a public building be used for alternate in-person absentee locations.
Thank you. Thanks for answering all my questions.
Thank you.
Chief.
All right.
Thank you.
Rebuttal?
While you're getting settled, I'm going to jump right in. If you're addressing standing, that's your principal issue, correct? And if I'm understanding your argument, you're suggesting that the legislature created standing for a complainant to go before WEC, in which case the complainant would be aggrieved by what was happening that they're complaining about. But is it your argument then that the complainant loses his aggrieved status once he receives an adverse decision from WEC? That doesn't seem very logical to me.
So we're not suggesting that a complainant loses adverse status at any point. I think the crux of our argument, and really I think what should be the crux of this case, is the injury in fact and the lack. As Justice Ann Walsh Bradley said, where's the injury here?
Why does that matter? The legislature in this statutory scheme didn't use the language injury in fact. It says, and I'm paraphrasing, that a complainant who thinks a clerk is not following the law can go before WEC. So the legislature created made that policy choice to create an avenue for a complainant to have a complaint heard. It seems that would be a meaningless action if then receiving an adverse decision, the legislature then strips the judiciary of its power of judicial review for WEC's interpretation and application of law. It doesn't make sense to me, your construction of the statute and importing Chapter 227 factors of injury in fact and all of that.
So I'm glad Your Honor brought up the power of judicial review and what the judicial power actually is. And I think the case law is absolutely clear that to exercise the judicial power, for courts to act, there needs to be an injury in fact. That is the quintessential requirement of standing in every case, an injury in fact, which is an injury that exists somewhere in the world. So that's, I've been harmed, my money has been taken, my property has been taken, I have suffered some physical injury, I've been injured in fact. That's separate from the statutory analysis. And the courts are clear. This court in First National Bank, I think, made it very clear that the injury in fact requirement is in fact a requirement for courts to act. And so before the legislature can say anybody can come to court, there needs to be an injury in fact. And here what we have is the legislature creating, I think, very importantly, two separate standards. In 506, the legislature said in sub 1, if you believe that the election laws have been violated, you can go to the commission and raise that complaint. But if you have a belief, that's not enough, even if the commission doesn't agree with your belief, to then go to court. You have to be aggrieved. And aggrieved has a meaning established in Wisconsin case law, and that does not mean merely participating in the administrative proceeding. This court's cases are very clear. If I could just finish that point, that the mere participation in an administrative proceeding, the City of Milwaukee case, Fox versus DHSS, Waste Management, Cornwell, I think there's a very long list of cases making clear that merely participating and then having your position denied is not an injury. And it isn't aggrievement.
Are you done?
I am. Thank you.
But you're relegating a complainant's complaint that WEC isn't following the law. You're relegating that to some participation in an administrative process. What would the point be for the legislature to give the complainant the right to go to WEC and say somebody isn't following the law, and then let's say WEC completely botches it and WEC gets the law wrong. You're suggesting then that the legislature says, sorry, it stops at WEC, and a court cannot come in and review that decision of an administrative agency construing a statute, the decision that somebody is following the law. You're saying that the judiciary doesn't get to come in? and review that decision. It doesn't make sense to me that the legislature sets up this scheme in tandem where, okay, you have enough interest complaining to go to WEC, but then we're going to stop, and you get an adverse decision, you're done. You have no avenue for appeal. That's a strange scheme, don't you think?
I think in every judicial review context, there needs to be the showing of aggrievement, and for that, we look to the underlying right. And here, what we've heard is the underlying right is that my belief was denied. But I think an example, and I see my light is up, if I could just give a hopefully brief response. If we have two complainants with diametrically opposed beliefs, one who believes that all votes in a municipality must be thrown out, another who believes that all votes in a municipality must be counted, neither of those comports with the law, but both of those then have an injury by not having their belief accepted. And when a court sees aggrievement, aggrievement means they have a right to that, to fix that. And so under Brown's conception of aggrievement, both of those diametrically opposed views would have to be corrected by a court and accepted. Brown's view cannot be right. Aggrievement requires an injury in fact, and we don't have that in this case. And Wisconsin law needs clarification that what we have does not state an injury in fact.
Chief, can I ask a question? I just want to ask a question about your friend on the other side talked about Hass, and he was kind enough to make about Hass in the last couple of weeks. He sent us a letter informing us of that. It was decided, I think, like July 30th. I want to give you a chance to respond because in paragraph 18 of Hass, it does say that after having filed a verified complaint with WEC under 5.06 and having received an unfavorable decision from WEC on that complaint, Hess clearly meets the qualifications of the statute as a complainant aggrieved by WEC's decision. So would you have us overturn that? I realize it hasn't been briefed, but I just want to make sure that I am really clear on where you stand because this came out of the Court of Appeals this summer.
So I think the shortest answer is yes, Hess would need to be overruled to make clear that that conception of standing in a 506 complaint ignores the injury in fact requirement. Now, the longer answer, Your Honor, is that Hess is very distinguishable on its facts. It involved a ballot access challenge. And there are very unique procedures in a ballot access challenge that actually use the procedures of 506, but it is not a 506 case. So it's distinguishable, but I think for the interest of precedent, Hess would need to be overruled to make it wasn't an injury there or here.
Thank you. Thank you, Chief.
Can I just ask one final thing? And maybe it'll spurn other things, but in a declaratory judgment or a Declaratory Judgment Act case where you're just asking a court to declare what the law is, who is the aggrieved party there?
So in the declaratory context, we don't have the statutory analysis. The statutory aggrievement analysis is a function of the judicial review statutes. In the declaratory context, there's still a standing requirement. There's a standing requirement in every case. And I think that is why it's so important to clarify what type of injury qualifies, because if this type of injury is recognized in Wisconsin law, then it could be brought potentially, certain bars aside, in the declaratory context. But I think the important takeaway here is that the sort of generalized grievance that we see in this case is not an injury in this case. It's not an injury in the declaratory context, and that to have an injury in fact, a voter needs to allege some impact on their right as a voter.
So how would the court be in a position to declare what the law is, or have we now given the judicial authority to declare what the law is to a commission?
Well, I think in the declaratory context, There's always a requirement of standing, and it's not giving away the power. I think the declaratory judgment...
I'm actually talking about your proposal here. So isn't that really delegating or abdicating the judicial responsibility to declare what the law is to a commission?
Not at all, Your Honor. Here, if there's no aggrievement, then there's no precedent. And so the commission isn't purporting to declare a rule that would be binding on courts, but the procedure...
Courts decide all sorts of things that aren't necessarily just binding on courts. They're binding on the public and litigants and interpret statutes and laws. The courts are where that issue belongs, right?
Which issue, Your Honor?
Deciding what the law is.
Absolutely. And when there is a case involving an infringement of rights, that belongs in the courts. But when we have a non-existent injury or a hypothetical or a speculative or an indirect injury, those are the quintessential requirements for standing that's lacking here.
Any other questions?
Yeah, just, sorry, one quick follow-up. Do you agree, you don't think that alternate sites are polling places?
No, separate treatment in the statutes and the importation of the building requirement into 6855, I think, isn't supported.
The definition in 5.02 of polling place is the actual location wherein the elector's vote is cast. So you would say that, I guess, would your argument be that that some people, the actual vote, I'm not sure how you deal with that. That people can cast votes at places other than the polling location, despite that definition?
Well, I think sort of separate from that, even if we accept that 5.25 has some bearing on 6.855, there's still the flexibility for clerks, and that clerks, if they choose, can designate something other than a public building. Under 5.2.
Other than a polling place, I guess, or whatever. Okay, sounds good. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Interesting oral argument. The court is adjourned, but we will reconvene at 1:30 for another panel.